I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. The fundraising war is heating up in the race for the governor's mansion, but 1 month after announcing his candidacy, Democratic challenger Charlie Crist is trailing Governor Rick Scott in campaign contributions. 90.7's political commentators Dick Batchelor and Lou Fry weigh in on the 2014 gubernatorial race and other political issues impacting Florida. Also, last week a 15-year-old West Orange High School student was shot during an altercation with another student as school was letting out. I'll speak with Orange County Public School District Superintendent Barbara Jenkins about the official response to the incident and what the district is doing to promote school safety. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined by 90.7 political commentators Dick Batchelor and Lou Fry. Dick Batchelor is a former Democratic State House representative. He's the founder and president of the Dick Batchelor Management Group. Welcome, Dick.
Good to be back. Thank you.
And, of course, joined by Lou Fry, a former Republican congressman, the founder of the Lou Fry Institute for Politics and Government at the University of Central Florida. Lou Fry, very good to have you along.
Happy holidays to everybody.
Well, it's been about a month since Charlie Crist announced he's running for governor. In his first month, he's been out-fundraised by Governor Rick Scott about 5-1. Lou Fry, is this what you expected?
Yeah. Anytime you can sit down, write a check up to $100 million out of a bank account, it's just not a question of if, it's a question of when he wants to do it. And that's, if you're thinking of running, you're always looking back over your shoulder. I think the interesting thing about that particular act, though, is his Chris's campaign chairman quit. Mm-hmm. He's got a lot of background in politics. Everybody knows about him. And when that happens, you start saying, hey, wait a minute. Now, why would it happen? Well, it could happen because he's not raising money here or in South Florida, and people are now going to be able to look on it. He's going to have to put his money up instead of talking about it. And, of course, the more he does that, the more the Bill Nelson, you know, governor's thing goes. So that could be one of the key things in the race is this initial give up, I guess, by the chairman.
Is that a bad sign for Chris? That kind of foreshadow that he's going to have a rocky road ahead in the next 12 months?
That, in my articulate manner, that's what really hit me. When that came out, Dick, a red flag went up, and I said, uh-oh, here's something interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, keep in mind two or three things. One is, first of all, Chris has only raised a little bit over $1 million, as you've inferred. Secondly, the PAC that was put together to support the governor's reelection, Governor Scott's reelection, has raised over $28 million already, and which is to be expected. When you're an incumbent governor, you're getting $250,000 checks from Florida Power and Light, from the Chamber of Commerce, from Florida Crystals, U.S. Sugar, and you're just counting that money in, and you have the ability to raise that kind of money, which means he's well on his way to spending $100 million if he wants to in this campaign, as he said he would do. The other thing that's kind of a parenthetic to this is Charlie Crist has a tremendous name recognition. Usually the first several $1 million you spend in five media markets of Florida is trying to get some name recognition. He has it, so he's, to that extent, ahead of the ball game. He might have $1 million in the bank, but he might have $20 million worth of name recognition mm-hmm. or more.
Sometimes that's not good, Dick.
It might not be good depending on your record. But if he doesn't raise another quick million, and I don't rule out, and I haven't ruled out ever, Nelson getting in this race.
Is this a good time for either of them to be raising money, though, over the Christmas New Year period?
No, now's not a good time, except, you know, and you probably won't raise much money over the holiday season. But again, if you got $1 million versus $28 million, I'm pre-FCAP, but I figure out the incumbent governor's ahead.
What about the timing of Crist announcing, you know, waiting that long to announce that he was in the race because, you know, his name was on the cards for so long? Do you think he miscalculated there?
Not necessarily. The real key is going to be, can he raise another quick $1 million? Again, if you can't, if the governor's got $28 million and you've got $1 million, even though he has a lot of name recognition, Charlie Crist does, it is still going to be formidable either way. But it's still, as Lou and I say, it's too bad, but it is the mother's milk of politics happens to be campaign contributions.
Yeah, and it does, and it follows a pattern. And the question always is, you know, are you going to run, show me the money? Mm-hmm. And at this point, people are scurrying around. Nan Rich, right, who's a Democrat running for the...
Now, we haven't talked about her because she's only raised $250,000, and she's a wonderful lady and got great record, in my opinion, but... You've got five large media markets, it takes millions of dollars to get recognized.
Well, Dick Batchelor, do you think Charlie Crist has the support of Democrats and more importantly, the pocketbooks? And I mean, has he really turned off all his former Republican allies?
Well, first of all, getting money from traditional Republican fundraisers is going to be nearly impossible for him. He might peel off one or two, but the major fundraisers he will not peel off. So the Republican support is gone. So now he's got to come to the Democratic Party and try to cozy up to the major Democratic fundraisers. And I said months ago, if he doesn't get the likes of Jim Pugh and Richard Swan and Mitch Berger and people like that behind him soon raising money for him, substantial money, he's in trouble because he doesn't have any Republican fundraising opportunities. And he has Democrat, but he's got to convince himself. He's got to convince them of himself running.
Mm-hmm. And not running out when it gets tough. I mean, seeing these jumps over, you're a little nervous. Even if he says the right thing, you're saying, boy, hasn't happened in real life. Now, what am I going to do? Am I going to hang in there and hang, or just hopefully we get another candidate?
And every blip, another story came up just today, just another hint that you can't rule Nelson out. Mm-hmm. He hasn't ruled himself totally out. He sort of kind of has, but he hasn't. He's handled it well. But then you try to raise money from, let's say, one of the people I mentioned. They say, well, look, I'm a Bill Nelson supporter, and I'm not going to make a contribution until I know what Bill Nelson's doing.
Right.
So now it's hamstringing his ability to raise money because, one, he's new as a Democrat, and number two, Bill Nelson, if he's not out, absolutely out, not getting in, then people can still say, I'm not getting in until I find out Bill Nelson's in or out.
You know, he told one of our reporters just last week that he wasn't planning to run and had no plans to, but then a couple weeks
before that,
he was reporting that he might consider it if Chris looked like he wasn't going to be able to take on Governor Scott. So he is kind of twisting in the wind a little bit at this stage.
He has no plans to run. It doesn't mean he couldn't have plans tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, if he does, I've tried to talk to him, and from what I feel just personally, and I think that here he is, he's in the Senate, 100 people, most powerful job up there. He's got seniority. They operate a lot in the Senate by the seniority, unlike the House, on an election basis. He doesn't have to travel all the time. He's home. He likes to be home. He's got a good family. I thought he was, he ought to really take a deep breath and think about it, because it's a decision that's going to keep him for 8 years at the grindstone. And I don't think it's good for the state. I think we need Bill Nelson where he is. Yeah. Showing the leadership as he is now, hopefully in some of the tax issues and so forth. And frankly, if you're running like now and you're a Democrat, you can really do what you believe, because you're not going to be there longer no matter what happens.
Right. Mm-hmm. If the Democrats retain control of the U.S. Senate, Bill Nelson, I believe, will be chairman of the Commerce Committee, which is obviously an extremely powerful committee.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the lieutenant governor. Of course, Scott's been without a lieutenant governor since March when Jennifer Carroll stepped down amid that internet cafe investigation. Seminole County Sheriff Don Esslinger was reported to have been considered for position, but he turned that offer down. And Hillsborough County Commissioner Sandy Merman and State Senator Tom Lee from Brandon are still being considered. Who would you say Scott's best bet is for this position, Lou Fright?
If we had it, I'd like to see a female, and I'd like to see a Hispanic.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's an opening there. The Republican Party has to learn that women do run. And also get involved in it, and I think also in terms of Hispanics, we have to find a better way to communicate, because there isn't a great deal of difference between, from what I've heard, that most of the Hispanics want is a house and a roof over it and some protection, a job. And I think it's an area the Republicans can work into, Dick, but they've sort of haven't worked it into it, and you can see it in the polls.
Yeah, I keep in mind, too, that our Orange County Public School Superintendent Barbara Jenkins, Dr. Jenkins, was under consideration, too, and ruled herself out, and that would have been a smart move, I-4 corridor, African-American female.
Mm-hmm.
But I agree with Lou. We've said this sometime before. Female Hispanic makes all the sense in the world for the governor. Because he really needs to find a way to appeal to the Hispanics. The Republican Party nationally is not, but he could do this with the right candidate.
It could be argued that the lieutenant governor helps grabbing additional voters in certain demographics and areas, of course, as you both have said, but maybe Governor Scott doesn't feel the pressure at the moment, especially with that massive fundraising cushion he's got under his belt.
But keep in mind, too, there's still going to be a race, whether it's going to be against Charlie Crist or eventually Bill Nelson. And I don't suppose to know what's going to happen there. But he's still going to have to do grassroots. He's still going to have to get out the vote, because it's a midterm election year. You don't have a presidential race. He's going to have to get out the vote. So the vote, Hispanic vote, is looms large in this state, whether you're talking about the Cubans in South Florida, Puerto Ricans in Central Florida. It's a very important vote. I think he's got to look at the demographics. That I just think you can't just go with a traditional fundraising and a white bread kind of approach to this campaign.
First thing you look for is somebody who can't hurt you.
Yes.
Yeah, that's number one. Number two, you look for somebody who has a niche of some kind or the other. Number three, you have somebody who could at least have a small following to do it. And number four, you look with somebody who has an outside thing going on, maybe a charity to help kids or save wolves or something like that. I mean, that's what you really do. And we've seen in the past that sometimes thank goodness the ticket didn't win with the people that were on it. Not that they were guilty of stealing anything or something, but they certainly weren't the type that could step up to be president.
It also depends on what the governor gives you as a role. If your role is, in addition to what Lou said, attending funerals, you know, you might look at it and say, look, I'd rather just be sheriff for superintendent of public schools. I've got influence there. And it depends on the role. Now, some of our governors in the past, Childs comes to mind, actually used his lieutenant governor, secretary of the Department of Commerce, you know, gave him a real role. He was really very involved in governing. And, of course, they had both had served together in the legislature. They both were seasoned politicians. But I think it really depends on what role. What is the scope of work I'm getting as lieutenant governor? Now, I might be just satisfied with just doing perfunctory stuff, but some people aren't.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. I'm speaking with political commentators Lou Fry and Dick Batchelor. You can join the conversation online on Facebook and Twitter. You can also send us an email, intersection@wmfe.org. Let me ask you now about Florida Secretary of State Ken Detzner, and he's facing some opposition after prohibiting election supervisors from accepting absentee ballots from anywhere other than their main offices.
Two observations on that. One is that he's getting blowback on it. The legislation was changed to make it better as far as voter participation. But getting back to the point, who actually asked the Department of Justice to do an investigation on whether or not this is voter suppression?
Mm-hmm.
Because right now, even in a special election, he is saying that notwithstanding what tradition was, you can only drop absentee ballots off or voting ballots off at the supervisor elections office, none of the other designated places. And who asked the Department of Justice to investigate? Bill Nelson. Is Bill Nelson running for governor? But I think he's getting some blowback from some of the commissioners, Pinellas County and Orange County, to say, look, let us do it the way we used to do it. It's a lot better. But some people on one extreme are calling it voter suppression.
Mm-hmm. Lou Fry, what do you think of that? Is it voter suppression, or is that just an extreme?
If it was voter suppression, they did a poor job of putting it together. I don't think they've only suppressed it, seems to me, is what they're doing and what they were saying.
Do you think there's a problem with the way absentee ballots are accepted as they are now, or as they were before Detzner came out with this?
I think it could be better, and I think it especially is important to do a little bit more for the people overseas and our soldiers and sailors and that, who basically have been cut out of a lot of the elections because it gets there too late or somebody doesn't do it and they drop the ball. And maybe we ought to just work with what we have to make that better and then solve the rest of the world's problems.
Moving on, Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi's leading the way in the Florida Supreme Court to remove a medical marijuana initiative from the 2014 ballot. We have talked about this initiative in the past, but Dick Batchelor, what's the argument being heard at the Supreme Court? What are the pros and cons there?
Well, keep in mind, first of all, that you have a limited number of words you can use in a proposed constitutional amendment. Secondly, that's not really necessarily being contested, but secondly, though, the most important thing, which is in the Constitution, is you can only address one issue. One topic can be addressed in any proposed constitutional amendment. As Pam Bondi, the Attorney General, is arguing that there's really more than one topic being addressed. And secondly, the overwhelming issue is whether or not it's medical marijuana only, restricting doctors to prescribe, and this is one way you could get medical marijuana. She's arguing that the language, and so is the House. The House also filed an amicus brief in the court saying that it was too loose and too liberal, and that people could go to the doctor and say, look, I'm having a tough time with anxiety taking this test in college. Can I get a joint? Well, she was making that argument. On the other hand, you've got John Mills, the former Speaker of the House, a constitutional lawyer, arguing in favor of it on behalf of John Morgan, and John Morgan's arguing in favor of it too. So that's where you see the bones of contention happens to be. Is it restricted to one topic, number one? And number two, is it too loose? Does it really go beyond medical marijuana?
And is it usually when you do these things politically, you're looking for a bigger turnout of those people who believe in you, right?
Yeah.
I mean, whether it's drugs or changing a tax deal or something, you got people with interest and a self-interest legitimately with the thing who have different feelings and they move it along. But you also could not be cynical, but just look at it a little bit and wonder if the people working on the, say, the liberal side of the party at this time are really unhappy about it or happy, whatever. But they're playing it in the legislature, and that's one thing in this we've got to watch and see how much people are willing to commit their own money for something that has impact, and maybe good or bad. I'm not saying that, but it's a pretty well spread out one, and I don't think it's very deep. A lot of water's mighty slim, man. Mm-hmm. You say in
well,
the Bahamas.
I think too. The interesting thing that I think Lou inferred too is John Morgan, as accused, putting this on the ballot just to increase the voter turnout amongst Democrats in the general election. You know, if it's so, it's smart. He's spending $1 million already on this. The real question would be to see if the legislature wants to deal with it, which they can. It doesn't have to be a constitutional amendment. The legislature could deal with this. And if you see the polls, the overwhelming support for this are amongst Democrats and Republicans. So will the legislature see that as a signal and say, rather than a constitutional amendment might be too widely drawn, too liberally drawn, do we just want to legislatively handle this and kind of
maybe
preempt?
Back to just like medical area where you need
very
it?
Very specific.
Yeah.
Very specific prescription.
Rifle
driven.
Shot, not a shotgun.
Right. Mm-hmm.
If I could just change gear a little bit, a quick look ahead, national politics, the deadline for a new budget from Congress is fast approaching, just over a month away, and the debt ceiling coming down again after that in February. Lou Fry, what are your thoughts here? Are members of Congress looking any closer to getting a solution here?
Any closer? I don't know if they're looking any closer. They're at least looking at a solution, though, and I think there's enough worry up among the members I've talked to about letting this thing go just one more time. This could be the straw that broke the camel's back. Mm-hmm. So they're really working in the committee trying to come up with it. They've only got something like 8 working days or 9 working days till the end of January. It would be inconceivable that we do another thing. We could kick it down the road a little bit, and they may end up doing that. They won't put the government under anymore. I think that argument would be off the table. But I just wish in some ways there was more pressure on them from the public.
Mm-hmm. And what you see is, as you know, the chairman of the Senate committee and the House committee, Mr. Ryan, have been working together, and there's some indications that they're reaching some agreement. It won't be unanimous by any stretch of the imagination, but it looks better than a government shutdown and what I call the great abyss. No one wants to see that action again, I don't believe. Senator Durbin this weekend basically said that they're basically address are two issues that are outstanding. One is, can you do a budget agreement but not extend unemployment benefits or handle the food stamp matter? Now, Senator Durbin has said he doesn't think it will hold hostage the whole budget on that issue. When a senior Democrat in the Senate says that, it gives some signal to the other Democrats. Maybe we'll get a budget approval. We might not get the extension of unemployment, and we might not get the food stamp issue, which is tied to the farm bill, put to bed in time. So there's some indication that I think they do not want to go look into the great abyss one more time. And apparently this budget, Lou, has some kind of rollback on the what's the word I'm looking for? The sequestration.
Sure.
It's got some accommodation on sequestration. So that might be appealing enough for Democrats and Republicans to come to some kind of a short-term agreement.
I've been speaking to Dick Batchelor. He's the former Democratic State House representative and head of the Dick Batchelor Management Group. Thank you very much, Dick.
Thank you.
And also 90.7 political commentator Lou Fry, former Republican congressman and an attorney at Lowndes, Drostic, Doster, Canter & Reed. Thanks for coming in, Lou.
Always a privilege.
Up next, a conversation with Orange County Public School District Superintendent Barbara Jenkins about student safety in the wake of an incident last week in which a student was shot. Joining me by phone is Orange County Public School District Superintendent Barbara Jenkins. Dr. Jenkins, thank you very much for joining me.
Happy to be with you, Matthew.
Well, of course, last week, a 15-year-old West Orange High School student was shot by another student after what appears to have been a fight between the two in the school's bus loop. Clearly a pretty fraught incident, a lot of law enforcement involved in the response to that. If you would just talk us through quickly, Dr. Jenkins, the school's reaction to the shooting, do you think things were handled pretty well in this case?
Sure, I'll talk you through it. So we have, thanks to local law enforcement, and I want to say up front, Sheriff Demings and his department have been extremely helpful, along with our other law enforcement partners in the area. We take our schools through what we call an active shooter drill, so that they are aware, administrators are aware of the steps that need to be taken when there's a weapon on campus. We also make sure schools go through lockdown drills as well. And so immediately when the incident took place, two things are critical. One is to tend to the student who has been injured. Secondly, we have to lock down, secure, in a safe setting, the remainder of the students that are available. And so from our debriefing, those strategies worked well. We are very pleased with the response from our administrators, those that had to attend to the child who had been injured, as well as those who had to get the other students secured.
What about the incident itself? Has anything come to light there in terms of, you know, what happened in this case and maybe what you can do to prevent further incidents like this in the future?
I think a couple of things are apparent. Number one, Matthew, there was not a plan or an intent to harm large numbers of students. It does not appear to be an incident that was headed in that direction. It appears that there was an altercation between just a couple of individuals. Our sheriff's department is still investigating. They've taken several statements. They've interviewed, I believe by this point, all of the witnesses. And I'm quite confident that they will come to some resolution in the next day or two around actual motivation. That depends largely on the actual shooter disclosing honestly what was taking place that day, as well as what the witnesses are able to share with the sheriff's department.
Now, I know that there are random metal detection screenings that go on in Orange County schools, but of course you can't predict, you know, where one of these firearms might pop up. So what does that tell you about the way these measures are working, or whether they need to be beefed up at all?
That's an excellent question, Matthew. I want to make a couple of things clear. We think random screening is an efficient and effective way to deal with our student population. It is, and I want to remind folks, we only started this in the spring of last year. It has not been going on for years. It's an initiative we took started up last year in the second semester. And so critical to random screening is that our administrators regularly remind students that they are under the possibility, the potential of a random screening at any time on any day of the school year. That's critical so students understand any day I show up at school, there may be a screening that takes place.
Are they screenings which happen just at the high schools, or are they at schools at any level, every level rather?
It can be at any level. I will tell you most of our focus would be at middle and high schools because it's far less likely that you would turn up items in an elementary school, but we don't rule out any school. It's a random screening aimed mostly at secondary schools, middle and high school.
Do you think we are heading towards a future where there'll be metal detectors in all schools at some point down the track?
You know what, Matthew, I don't suspect, number one, that there'll be the funding to support something that significant. But here's the thing. The greater issue is around the community at large and how children and minors are getting their hands on weapons. And so if you try to lock down the schools, then it could happen at a park, it could happen at a movie theater, it could happen at a library, it could happen anywhere in the community where groups gather, at a gymnasium, at a rec center. So it's not so much that putting full-time screening mechanisms in the elementary school would solve all of our community's problems around inappropriate use of weapons and children having guns. The issue is a much larger one about society and how do children get their hands on weapons in the first place.
Let me ask you too, Dr. Jenkins, the extra measures in terms of random metal detection screenings and the like that came in last year, was that a response to the aftermath of the Sandy Hook shooting, or was that something more just that the county was looking at to try and you know, increase the sense of security for students?
Yeah, we had been looking for some time at security measures. In fact, our district as a whole is looking at consultants to do extensive review of all of our facilities. But we've been looking for some time at how we make sure that our schools are absolutely as safe as possible. What Sandy Hook did, Matthew, was bring everyone's attention to that matter. We didn't just start having lockdown drills and concerns around inappropriate predators on campus and how you keep children safe. That's been a process in works for some time. I think Sandy Hook escalated it, the attention brought to it for the entire community.
Now, the outside consultants who are looking at security across Orange County Public Schools, how long are you expecting them to take to make some kind of finding, and what would be the next step after they come back with whatever they find about security at the schools?
And so, if you don't mind, I'd rather not be specific, because a part of our security measures are that they're confidential. So I don't want to disclose timelines so folks think somehow there's an opportunity or a window when there might be less exposure. What I will tell you is the board has already committed dollars and resources, over $5 million since last year, around certain security measures, something as simple as making sure we have secured perimeters, appropriate fencing around schools that had some open access to the public. We tried to narrow that access to a single point of entry. We've gotten been very diligent about volunteers and checking in and screening and making sure anyone on campus is accounted for. And we've escalated the kind of drills that we put in place. The active shooter drill, as terrible as it sounds, is something that we take very seriously so that staff and administrators are prepared. And I want to stress, Matthew, our schools, we believe, are extremely safe. Our incidents have been minimal, but one incident, one child being harmed, is just one too many. And so our board is very supportive. They will do whatever it takes to make sure that we provide safe campuses for our children. We have that commitment.
Do you feel like, especially in this case where social media was kind of used, I know that Principal Szczynski at West Orange High was pretty active and jumping on that as quickly as he could and using that to reach out to students and parents. Do you think that worked effectively in this case? And do you think that, you know, I know that he made some comments saying, look, don't spread rumors on social media, use it instead to get good information across and don't believe stuff that isn't verified. Is social media working for you in situations like this?
I think it is working for us. We have to reach families and parents and students in the realm where they live, and the instant nature of social media for getting the word out has to be used as a tool to the good. Now, that being said, I think we have to acknowledge that our teenagers, who may not be as mature or using the best judgment at all times, will use that same media to inappropriately use their phone to get a snapshot of a child in distress, and then publish that or post that as well, which seems a little bit less than sensitive to the person who was injured. But I think you have to take the good with the bad. The good part about social media is that we can instantly communicate and take advantage of getting the word out and providing some rumor control with authentic information. The bad news is, quite frankly, sometimes young people use it to get out information that should be kept more private.
I've been speaking to Orange County Public Schools District Superintendent Barbara Jenkins. We've been talking about school security. Dr. Jenkins, thank you very much for joining me.
Always a pleasure, Matthew.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.